to Chicago, and I'm sorry that I can't take you. Ain't nothing in Chicago for a sweet little boy like you to do. 'Cause when I get there, I'm gonna drink mash, I'm gonna talk trash, gonna spend my money in the morning. Drink mash, talk trash, I'm gonna spend my money in the morning. Gonna have me one hell of a time till I see me a rooster sitting right in the middle of Rush Street crowing for the dawn, man.
That's Ernestine Anderson, the great Ernestine Anderson, with Going to Chicago Blues. That's from her 1984 album, When the Sun Goes Down. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Friday, January the 23rd. My goodness, a whole month almost has gone by. And it's Free Your Mind Friday, the day that you bring to the forum this open exchange of information, opinions, and ideas, whatever is on your mind. Hopefully it will be well-reasoned, and you will have a sense of humor, and you will, of course, we always insist on respect here. So those are the rules, if we could call them that. 888-874-4888 is the number to call and get things started. A couple of notes. This week was particularly interesting from the point of view that, my gosh, we had this this collision from all over the world, all kinds of news meeting up. And it just goes to show that, you know, the world is going along at a frantic pace. And for some reason this week, it felt like, my gosh, what the heck is going on? What's in the water all over the world? People are doing awful things, crazy things that are happening. But also, of course, we have the trouble here at home. And this situation with Benjamin Netanyahu imposing himself at the invitation of John Boehner to basically utilize the Congress as his platform for any number of objectives was particularly disturbing, I found. You know, I mean, just on basic manners, it was just so bad to do that, and then to try and justify it on both their counts, it seemed a bit much. And it kind of bristled me a bit, but that's just me. 888-874-4888. And I'm particularly looking for people who haven't called in before. Perhaps this would be your first time calling in. We do like the idea of having some new voices, giving some space to people who write me all the time and tell me, you know, I love the program and I don't quite yet have the courage to call. You don't need any courage to call. You just need to call and share your ideas and your thoughts and opinions. They will be well received. And of course, we'll be happy to hear from you. All right, let's get started. We have Harvey, who is up first.
Hello, wonderful Eutrice, once again.
Hello, Harvey. How are you doing?
Very good, thank you. And I had some interesting thoughts I'd like to share with you and your fantastic audience. And I believe that reincarnation is real. And I believe that it's fractal. And fractals are... they're part of our everyday life. We're fractal. And for instance, our veins, arteries trigger off of the veins and then off of the arteries, you get capillaries, and it's like a way a tree grows, branching off of things, and all these are signs of fractal, the fractal nature of nature itself. And it's based on something called iteration. And iteration is the process of repeating itself, but each repetition is different. And to give you an idea of iteration, we live all the days of our life, but each day is different. Or people are born of people that are born of people that are born of people, but each person is different. And so life is fractal. And I feel that if that reincarnation is part of that fractal nature, and so it makes sense then that we are born lifetime after lifetime after lifetime, but each time it's different. It's as though our past lives are the memory of it are swept away, and we become someone new, not necessarily a person either. I personally believe that there's the possibility that life itself is experiential, and that maybe next time you want to know what it is to be a fish, so you're born into a fish body, or perhaps a bird body, or some off planet, another planet. It doesn't have to be Earth, so there's no limitations on it. But it fits. It all fits into the fractal nature, which is everywhere. Everything is fractal. The way things grow, the way clouds look, the way water flows. It's all fractal in nature, and this is all found. So I recommend once again, look at the most beautiful thing in the world is 3D fractals on YouTube. You'll see the incredibleness of it. It's something. It's beyond art. So that's my thing today is that I believe that reincarnation is fractal and that reincarnation is real.
Okay. It's hard to argue because we have no conclusive proof one way or the other as to what, if there is reincarnation, and whether, as you propose, it's a fractal experience. So we'll just have to take you at your statement today.
Thank you. Wonderful, Eugene.
Thank you, Harvey. 888-874-4888. Maud, you on the air.
Yes, peace, my sister. Good day to all. First, a request. Please bring our attorney at war, Brother Alton Maddox, on for a session where we get to control the stream in that I have a number of questions for him, and I'd like to get a few through. I want to, and speaking about Radio Family, that's what we are, I want to unravel what I say is a misunderstanding, or if I could add some levity to the situation, as Ruby Dee said in, I think it was a book or a play, on her One Last Nerve. So I seem to have hit a raw nerve in you. I didn't mean to. When I brought up Democracy Now, I understand that you've seen some injustice, some great injustice around that situation, and one day you might unwrap that for us. But I was bringing up her program on January 13th that was a very important program because it asked the question, how did this idea of terrorism get started? And what it's all about. One of the guests was a Harvard professor, Lisa Stampnitsky, and she did a book called Disciplining Terror, How Experts Invented Terrorism. She also was with Glenn Greenwald, and they discussed the fact and showed clips of these experts that aren't experts at all, and they were recently they were shown in some big lies about no-go Muslim zones, and it was very interesting. And even a broken clock, you treat is right twice a day.
A couple of things. I just want to before you go a little further. One is inviting Alton Maddox where you said the listeners would get to control the interview. I want to make a comment here. One of the reasons that Alton Maddox has been on the program and in the format that we have had is that there were specific questions that needed to be asked. And I don't mean to sound prideful, but I considered myself probably the best person to ask those questions because there was a point, knowing his history, and I've known him for more than 30 years, there's a point, knowing his history, that we can know how best to use the time. And the time was for learning and affording him the ability to stretch out on the topic of informing the public of the ins and outs and the minute details of what we discussed as the travesty of the Eric Garner and the Michael Brown cases, and based in a matter of law, and based in a matter of a particular kind of law that he has been practicing. So there was the opportunity to raise a question, but I agree with you. The interviews were essentially interviews between me and him. And frankly, I don't feel the need to apologize for that. I think it was important. Let me just finish. It was important to do the interviews that way because I felt it would have been more productive to not have him, the stream of thought and the focus interrupted with different questions. He's always going to be invited here, and hopefully at that time when we can open up and people can ask questions relevant to the topics that we are discussing. And this is really important. The interviews were vitally important, I think, to understanding the structural nature of the prosecutions or the lack thereof in these two particular cases, and a history, the context for them as well. So I considered them classes, and my job was to facilitate the information in an uninterrupted way so that people can get the best out of what it is they needed to know. Secondly, with Amy Goodman and Democracy Now!, I don't know why you would imply that I had a problem with it. I don't have a problem with Democracy Now! I know the origin of the program. I know it was created by Samori Marksman and by Bessie Wash, two wonderful African Americans. I know the program was hijacked. I know the program has served as the basis for a private enterprise that has sapped Pacifica of millions of dollars. I know that. And I know it is one of the reasons that WBAI and the entire Pacifica network is in deep financial straits at the moment, because even strapped as it is, Pacifica is committed to paying, I believe, upwards of $2 million a year to Democracy Now!, a program that is the intellectual property of Pacifica, which, of course, it's now paying for at a private company to produce and paying to receive. So I'm not at all disillusioned about it. In fact, I made it very clear when I was there what the situation was with regard to that particular program. So I don't know why you would imply that I have a problem with Ms. Goodman herself. I don't.
No. Am I able to respond now?
Sure.
Yes. Well, first of all, I agree with you that it's very important to have structured interviews with Alton. I don't think we have any problem with that, but I did hear a caller like myself that has certain questions also from their perspective, from my perspective, and you did say that you would be bringing him back, so I'm just reminding you, we'll be looking forward to that. And I appreciate your sharing the information around the situation, which is the overall situation at BAI Pacifica. And I was just sort of using a bit of levity, if you will, by saying that I didn't think that you would really not be able to deal with a Democracy Now! Program. That was more my tongue in my teeth.
No. In fact, I like the idea that everybody should contribute to the aggregate knowledge that we have. It is just that this particular effort is one that I'm intimately familiar with.
Yes, indeed. And if I could make my last point, which some of the callers tried to make. I was speaking about facts. I do know facts. So the, in terms of the France situation, and we must keep in mind that governments lie about everything. I mean,
no
even when
question. What I was saying, just to clarify, mm-hmm. it is important here on this program, as you know. I like strong opinions. I really love them. I also, though, insist that along with your strong opinions, be real careful to point out when they are facts and when they're not, or when you're thinking this is the situation, as opposed to saying, well, this is the situation. And that's what all I'm saying. The point you made about Paul Craig Roberts, was that you were citing different sources and, in effect, saying these were facts. And what I was trying to say to you was that even Paul Craig Roberts was just putting together or just presented plausible ideas based on his experience or based on his opinions or based on what he, the knowledge that he has. These were plausible ideas, but he never went across that line to say that these are facts. Your opinions were good, but we had some trouble with the factual defense of your opinions.
Well, when Paul Craig Roberts, who I was pleasantly surprised, I didn't catch that program with him on Obamacare, but you know, this is a man with gravitas, former assistant treasury secretary, et cetera, et cetera. But what I was confused about or confounded about, because he started out, when I heard him on the Power Hour with Joyce Rowley, he started out talking about facts, and then at the end saying, well, we can't come to definite conclusions, but mm-hmm. he really was talking about facts, such as the ID, in other words, who the suspects were and who we'll never hear from because they were killed, as happens too often.
But this is the tactic that bothers me. You can't throw it all together and then present the body of work as facts. And then, you know, in small print later on, you say, well, you know, these are just my ideas. That does not make it, in my view, it doesn't make it kosher. You have to say whether you have facts or you don't. Don't contrive a scenario, which is a contrived scenario, and then present them as facts only in the last paragraph or last sentence or in fine print if it's in publication. You say, well, you know, these are just my opinions, and the publication that is printing this has nothing to do with it. We just have to change that. That's all I'm saying. We have to ramp up our presentations that way.
Well, maybe
thanks
at
for
some
calling.
Point.
Hmm? I'm sorry, are you there? Okay, she's gone. From Brooklyn, Calvin, you're on the air.
Sister Lutrice, how are you?
Hello. Fine, thank you. How are you?
Good. Sister Lutrice, that program you had on the other day about Netanyahu?
Yes.
Was so pointed, and I haven't heard that since somebody like Ralph Shulman coming on the air. Okay, and it was so special hearing that. And I think that's one of the most important issues we need to deal with today. I mean, okay. We don't need to deal with, you know, a lot of other stuff, because it seems like the APEC has taken over the American government.
Well, it certainly does have that disturbing view. I mean, it is mind-boggling that we as a nation, we are not particularly perturbed about this. It's not being discussed in the press, but I thought, you know, this is not even whether you like Obama or not. The man is president of the United States.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, it's like going into somebody's house and telling them how long they should live there. how long you're going to allow them to continue to live in their own house.
Right.
Get out of here with that stuff.
And I hadn't heard, I didn't catch that young lady's name who was on the program.
That's Janet McMahon. She is the editor of the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs.
Oh, okay, okay. And I'm the brother that always tell you every time I see you that you're my spiritual wife.
I know who you are. Thank you, Calvin.
Okay.
Thank you so much for calling.
And again, any kind of information I can find about Ralph Shulman, because that program made me think of a program that Ralph Shulman used to have.
I don't know. I should check, really. I have lost touch with it, but it's
okay.
A good idea to check. Thank you so much for that.
Thank you, sister. Bye-bye.
Thank you. From Chicago, Henry, the great Henry who traveled all the way on January 9th. And I so regret not having breakfast with you the following day.
Oh, my God. If you would have told me, I would have went to breakfast with you because my flight didn't get out until 1:30 the next day. So I was like, man, if you would have said something to me, I would have been like, I was there.
I didn't think about it until actually being in the moment, because it was you, it was Mamadou from Texas, and somebody, I don't remember his name actually, who came from far out of town. And I said, my gosh, this would be great if we could get together the next day and have some breakfast. And by the time I looked around, it was you were gone, and Mamadou was gone, and I'm saying, where did everybody go?
Well, I'll say this: the next event, if I happen to travel somewhere or you happen to be here in Chicago, we will have breakfast the next day.
Thank you. It was so wonderful, really seeing you there. I was stunned, actually. I was shocked.
But I was
so taken aback by that. And the feeling of the evening was one of great fellowship, I thought. And people had a need to connect with people. I really loved that aspect of it.
It was a great event because of the fact that, you know, we all share a fondness of a commonality of the teachings of Dr. John Henry Clark, because I think I expressed to you before how, you know, even after his transition from Earth, just watching him speak and reading some of his stuff on history has just, you know, has just changed the consciousness in me about, you know, about history, not only just Black history, but just history in general, you know. So right. it was a very profound event, you know, just listening to some of his students. Co-professors and teachers that were there that worked with him, and listened to their testimonies. And, you know, it was a great thing to hear and see and be there. I want to segue into what I really want to talk about in regards to history. Yesterday, I was actually listening to an interview on WBAI in regards to the movie Selma, because I know the other day you had an entertainment critic on talking about
Armin White. He's a film critic, yes,
yeah,
film and,
critic.
And okay. Culture critic,
yes. And so I was listening to an interview on WBAI. Can't think of what the show is, but they were interviewing a couple of people who were in SNCC, who were at that event during that time. So it was so interesting because I actually saw Selma Monday, and it was so interesting to hear the interview from these actual people who were there within SNCC, talking about the rift between SNCC and the Southern Christian Leadership Group, because it gave me a different perspective on how I, you know, viewed the movie. Because when I viewed the movie, it was kind of like, it was very entertaining, but it was kind of strange, you know, how they kind of dramatized things and how they made, you know, the Southern Christian Leadership people coming in as like the saviors, where, you know, what I used to read about SNCC, they used to do a lot of things, you know, to try, you know, for civil rights movements, you know, before King and the Southern Christian Leadership came in. So it was a very interesting spin on it. And to kind of segue into something that you had last week on the Charlie Hebdo situation, because I wanted to call in that day, but I was a little too late. You know, it's strange that a lot of our, you know, news is coming from satirical, like, comments and papers. And it to me, it's kind of disturbing because of the fact that, you know, with the Charlie Hebdo thing, they're basically using racist, you know, they're basically just generally using expressing racist remarks in the form of the First Amendment's right. And, you know, all they can say is, well, you know, it's satirical. You know, we're just joking. Ha, ha, ha. It's very funny. But, you know, stuff like this is very disturbing and troublesome to me, you know, and how we're, you know, how we're being influenced by Hollywood in regards to, you know, learning about history. Because, you know, when I was talking to somebody about Selma, you know, they were asking me, well, how historically accurate it is. Well, you know, it's Hollywood. You know, so it's not going to be very historically accurate. You know, if you really want to read about, you know about Selma, do some research, you know, read about it, you know, ask some people who were actually there. Because, I mean, there are a couple of people who were actually there that are still alive. So, it's a disturbing trend where, you know, we don't want to read or research anything. We just want to watch the movie and learn from that. And I kind of find it a little disturbing to a point, because if you're trying to learn something new about Selma, you know, or what happened in Selma, you know, don't watch the movie. Go and read about it, or go ask somebody who was there. So that was just.
What did you get out of Amon's critique?
Well, I mean, what I got out of his critique was, you know, I guess he mentioned, and pardon me if I misquoted or misphrased it, but I guess he didn't like the movie because he felt it wasn't a very well done movie. As far as the movie itself, I thought it was done pretty good. I mean, it was entertaining, and I was entertained by it. But I mean, of course, you know, that's just my opinion of it. I mean,
well,
I
let's just stick with that phrase. You know, it was entertaining. It just so happened that this was was meant to convey one of the most critical in recent years, in recent time. One of the most critical developments, and it basically was a fight for freedom, a fight for equality and justice in the United States. I would tend to say that no other group would treat that as entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. There would be a sanctity about it, a sense of, you know, this is, we have to get this thing right. We've got to get mm-hmm. it right or not do it at all.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, you know, Armin's point was that this was a huge venture backed by very wealthy people, and they sank a lot of money into marketing. And they therefore believed that this would have emerged with the stamp of approval of Hollywood. And in any event, he made the point that the movie was not meant for blacks. The movie was meant to appease white America.
And I agree with him on that point as well. And, you know, to me, entertainment just doesn't mean a happy story or happy-go-lucky story, or, you know, I have to always be happy. Entertainment to me is, it just allows me not to use my imagination and allow somebody else mm-hmm. to use their imagination. But, you know, to me, it doesn't, but like I said, I didn't learn anything new out of it. I didn't expect to learn anything new out of the movie. But, you know, like I said, it was just a form of entertainment. And I right. do agree that if there were white people who didn't know anything about it, this movie was basically for them, in their view.
Thanks so much for calling.
Okay,
and
no problem.
I'll try to see if we could hook up Breakfast in Chicago. Let's see if we can work on that as a project. From Mount Vernon, Jason, you're on the air.
Hello, Latrice. How are you?
Fine, thank you. And how are you?
Well, going through the days and emotions of the days and the trials and tribulations that take place within our area of New York and the greater outside area. I know that you had discussions about the internal integrity challenges in the so-called progressive movement, left-leading movements and any initiatives to hold them to task on various matters in previous calls. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So, what I've always had a contention with is that those who are in a progressive movement and on the far right, on the far left, have to clean up their own backyard. And that's not an order or as meant to be a declaratory statement. It's meant to be as a healing process or a nurturing process, meaning our own backyard, our own get our own act together. And part of cleaning up our own backyard and cleaning up our act is acknowledging the gross disparity and the blatant racism that takes place within these progressive movements. Case in point, you mentioned the millions of dollars invested into from Pacifica, thrown into Democracy Now. That show, broadcast, journalism, media, I've been there. There has never been a single black male or black female ever hired in a position of any high authority. They may be someone who is a clerical or a janitor or a temp, but they're not there. This is all goes, this is pervasive. This is very pervasive in the Nation magazine, Progressive Democrats for America, Move On, take your pick. So when we have these struggles and these kumbaya moments of Eric Garner and police brutality and killings, they're just at the heat of the moment. But once the placards are taken down and put aside and people go their merry ways, there still is this disparity of deep disleveraged population in the state of New York, in New York, and elsewhere, where we're not even at the table of the very movements that are sparked by us, that originate from us.
Well, I agree with that. This is something that I have been critical of for many, many years. I don't hide it. It's one of the things that I've been talking about, that if, and this is part of what I keep asking the progressive community, what is the nature of the conversation that we ought to be having relating to the role of whites in transforming the society? And I always point out the fact that, you know, it seems as if the idea is we'll handle the heavy stuff, the thinking part. We will control that. And you could do the heavy lifting. That's how I have historically framed it. I dislike it. I point it out all the time. I know many organizations that, you know, they just blindly refuse to deal with these issues. And so the credentials should be called into question. I really believe that.
Absolutely. Yeah. May I speak?
Sure.
Sure. See, you hold them to task, but I would say that because of the issues and the conversations that you have and others have sparked, and it's not just you, others have put this to notice this as well. Those who are white or supposedly are white, but it does a disservice to the entire movement itself. It's the cancer, or I would call it a virus that's already part of the greater virus of exceptionalism versus dispensable people. And this is the notion that you are exceptional based on your heritage or your skin color. Therefore, you're entitled to different privileges and your and benefits and so forth. And you are insulated, lack of a better word, insulated from any type of draconian measures or police state actions. You feel you walk in the streets, or you live in your house, you have a 9-to-5 job, you have a comfortable middle class living or upper middle class living. You're not poor, and you're all white, and it's a backfire mechanism where you're taking for granted your privileges because of exceptionalism. You're an exceptional person, and it is a sick cancer mindset to have because it has blowback. Those who are dispensable or those who are being propagandized as being dispensable, people of color, immigrants, minorities, even women are in that dispensable category. They are the ones that should be lifted up, recognized, and placed in positions of power in order to move all our initiatives forward. Otherwise, we're running in circles because we're having this conversation, and of course this conversation should continue, but the conversation will be a never-ending cycle when there is no remedy and no results at all.
So, Jason, I mean, you have, a very accurate reading of the situation. What, therefore, is a workable idea from your point of view?
Well, there's so many workable ideas. One is that there should be a consensus where those who are in the prominent positions stop gloating, stop being unsatisfied and discontent with the millions and millions of dollars that you're raking in, and decide to have a consensus to bring those of fallen humanity or those fallen from society to uplift them. And those who are qualified, just like you said, check their credentials. If they're qualified to be working in different public sectors, so be it. Deliberate action of hiring. We talk about affirmative action. All I see is affirmative action from white people, affirming that you're hiring a white person in that act of affirmative action. I don't see too much affirmative action of hiring from minorities, people of color, particularly black women and black men in any private sectors. All over New York City, it's not really there. I mean, 6:30, 7:30 in the morning till 9 a.m., I see a whole trove of an avalanche of people going to work, but mostly white women and white men at this time. A solution to this would be knock on the door of Patricia Gatling, who I believe is the head of the Human Rights Commission in New York for discrimination and hiring practice, and put her to task, and that organization to task. Also, the city council, put them to task on these in these initiatives, as well as our progressive movements, the Nation magazine, MoveOn.org, Democrats for America, the Progressive Alliance. Take your pick. I mean, it's hypocrisy. It's hypocrisy. It's a false sense of entitlement, and these mechanisms that insulate all white brothers and sisters who think that they are not who think they're above of a police state or being victimized by a police state. These are the comfortable, leisurely benefits, and also they also have a reverse consequence, because if you think you're in cloud nine all the time, then you're naive or oblivious to the problems that are facing our reality, and then you pick up the New York Times, or God forbid the New York Post, and you see all these different social disorders coming along, or social misevils, or social unrest, and you wonder why they're happening. Why? Because you're living in cloud nine.
Thank you very much, Jason, for your very sobering call today. Hope to hear from you again soon. From Charlotte, Elito, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Eutrice.
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing well. I'd just like to say good afternoon to everyone listening to PRN today.
Thank you.
I'd like to say that I haven't listened to the show in the last week, so I'm kind of guilty. I don't know what the issues are for the last week. But I can say I took your challenge, and I joined a group called Guerrilla Poets. And it's like an organization, a collection of poets that like to do outreach things for the community, like homeless LGBT youth that are here in Charlotte. Also, they like
Elito, could you tell us what the challenge was and how you arrived at the idea that you better take it up?
Well, I like to write poetry, and the group that hosts poetry events, they're really active in the community, so I thought it was something that to bring up social issues through poetry is it's a good way to connect with people and share similar interests and try to make sure that that's a way of building up community.
Well, this was a way, I had talked about this year, if we could find a way to shine our own little lights that we have, and everybody has a light, and this is your way of shining your light. So how are you using that?
Besides connecting with people, just showing that there are people out here, even though we don't have the greatest platforms, we don't have our own radio shows, or we're not on TV, there's still a way that you can impact, not only to shine your own light, but to show other people that they have a light too, and there's a forum, and there's a way that they can shine their light as well.
Have you done any performances yet, or are you just getting people used to the idea that there's poetry in everybody?
I think it was this past Wednesday. I did a piece along with a couple of other poets in the group with some youth, and I believe they were in middle school, so I think they were seventh graders. So just to show them that you can channel poetry to write about situations like Ferguson, or even if you're having a good day and you're happy, or you know, you play sports and you want to let people know that you have different talents and different things that you're interested in. Poetry is a way and an outlet to let those things or let those feelings to be heard to everyone.
Elito, this is wonderful news. And, you know, if you could keep us posted, and we would like to have some of your fellow poets tell us, you know, how things are coming along with them, and perhaps do a presentation on the program.
Oh, that would be very awesome. Thank you.
Thank you. And keep in touch and let me know, truly.
Okay, not a problem.
All righty. Thanks so much for your uplifting call today. Well, she was late on the draw, but she's here. It's Sarah.
Greetings, you, Teresa. Greetings, PRN audience.
Hello, Sarah. How are you?
Eutrice, I am doing great, Eutrice. It is Friday. The rain has stopped falling, and I'm going to enjoy this weekend.
Good for you.
Well, yes, ma'am. And the same goes for the audience. I hope you all have an enjoyable weekend and just do something relaxing, because it's been a very stressful week. But, Eutrice, what I wanted to speak on, and I'm glad a caller from Chicago touched a bit on the movie aspects and the critics that you had on, because I had a chance to listen to the program on yesterday with him, and I was in somewhat disagreement with him on a few things that he said. But before we get to that, what I wanted to go back to is on Dr. Martin Luther King Day on this past Monday, and the vice president, he made an appearance at one of the events for Dr. King in a black community. And what he said, it totally and truly ticked me off. Because here it is that you're going to come to a gathering for Dr. King, and you're going to talk about police officers' lives matter, and they have a right to go home safe to their families. Now, this is the insensitive nature about this administration and the things that they have continuously done to stick their fingers in the eyes of black people, and we sit back and we take it. This is supposed to be about Dr. King. This is not about the police organization, because these cops that died in New York, the vice president showed up there to eulogize them. The governor, everyone showed up in New York to eulogize them. They didn't go to Ferguson. They didn't go to the Brown funeral. They didn't do none of that to the Gardner funeral. So it showed you how these people have aligned themselves and they've chosen what side that they want to be on. And for us to keep thinking that we have a friend in this administration, these people are tone deaf. They are completely tone deaf, and they have no concept about what they say, because you see, I would not go to somebody else's gathering, because if this is supposed to be about Dr. King, I need to address issues that pertain to Dr. King. I don't need to go and plead the police case. The police have been doing an exceptional job, because over this past weekend gone, they had a rally where the police wives, they had a rally in Washington, D.C., and I believe in Seattle, Washington, saying that police lives matter. So it shows you that these people, they don't have any concept, or they really don't care. Let's call it what it is. They do not care, because they think their lives are more important, and because they went to the police academy, they were given a gun and badge, they think that their lives are more important than the people who they are supposed to be protecting and serving and who's paying their salaries. And they've continuously done it, and they've continually showed us that they really don't give a darn about us.
Okay, point now, made.
Now, to the movie situation and with Selma, and I'm glad that you mentioned to the young man that when we go to movies like these, We need to go into the movies with an idea of we're going to learn something, and we're going to see what's missing, what's been left out. We're not going to go there to enjoy, because that is what these people, that's how they get you sucked in. Because they put everything for entertainment value, and we always fall for it, and we go to enjoy ourselves, because the Selma episode is not about enjoyment. What those people went through, it has nothing to do with enjoyment. Because we can see 50 years later that what's going on all across the country is as if though it never happened. The cycle was just dormant, and then it has just reemerged itself again today. So we cannot just say that, you know, you cannot just take a part of history and then write it based on what your concept is, on your integrationist mentality, and then you're going to put it on a big screen and then rewrite everything because, from what I read, that the King did not give authorization for any of Dr. King's speeches to be part of this movie. So they had to do creative licensing in order to come up with something of what Dr. King said and everything else. But they have totally went totally off script, because for you, for instance, the very important people in this movie, for instance, like Mrs. Ella Baker of SCLC, you had Dr. Kwame Ture of SNCC. You had Mrs. Fannie Lou Hamer of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. These are all things that are part of this. They didn't get no mention. You know, they got absolutely no mention. These people were all key part of the people for this movement in Selma, and they were a part of this organization. So we cannot let people do creative licensing with our history, because the Jewish people are not going to let you take their Holocaust and make a slapstick buffoonery about it and showing them, you know, just having a good time. They're all in concentration camps, kick back, you know, eating cheese and sipping wine and doing all this kind of foolishness. They're not going to do it, and they have a right not to, because that's a very drastic moment in their history. And black people, we've got to stop. But we've got to let people take our history and lampoon it and make it into a comedy. There's nothing comedic about our existence right now as it stands. And I thank you, you three, for allowing me to express myself, because yesterday you sound like me on your last part. So
I was channeling my inner Sarah.
Yes, ma'am. And please, people, you know, remind them again to send that money in, because I did got mine at my husband's, and it's on its way for Friends of Alton Matter. So please remind them at the end of the show to go ahead and get those money orders and get them sent in.
Well, thank you so much for your call. The thing is that the latest development that the federal government, the U.S. Justice Department, may not indict, or more than likely will not find a reason to indict Darren Wilson for the shooting death of Michael Brown. The point I wanted to make was that and this is goes back to the call earlier today, the reason for the my Sarah moment yesterday was to say, you already know this. If you listen to this program, you know it. And you know it because Alton Maddox and I took our time to delineate in minute detail to you why these cases would have resulted in no indictments. And that was the reason. Thank you so much for your call. From Brooklyn, Positive, you're on the air.
How you doing, Latrice?
Fine, thank you.
First of all, I initially wanted to had a issue with a few things that took place, but it was nothing big because I know your spirit. I met you back way back when at the Dempsey Center when they had a Lumbe there and like a table roundhouse you had there. I know your spirit. I know the spirit you have with Automatics is purely positive. I miss the show you had on when you was on BAI when you had your protege on with you, at least I call me your protege. You and the rest of you, and where you guys had your show, I missed your morning show.
Thank you so much.
How you always would say, the creek don't rise, which he used to utter himself. I miss that. So I know your spirit, and I know when you was talking to the sister that you meant you had very good intentions, so I'll let that be as it may. You know, she had a good point. I like her spirit. And as you said about Sarah, who has the same name of my mother, who passed in 2010, Sarah as well. I love her spirit as well. Again, sister, accolades to you, and I hope that you continue to go on. And even though you're not with mainstream media,
never
the way
have
you
been.
Come, the
never
way you
have
teach,
been, and that's been my choice. Never have been in mainstream media.
Exactly, they couldn't handle you anyway. So be it.
Well,
with
thank
that,
you.
I,
so what
I,
are
like
you
I
saying
said,
today?
I wish you a happy new year and. Like I said, tell Sarah and the people that had a spirit like Sarah and the other sisters and anybody that thinks outside the box with the helping of yourself, you know what I'm saying, keeping them on that path, continue on, you know, the fight goes on and on. And with that, I say peace.
Okay, well, thank you. That was a wonderful call, a nice uplifting call there. Thank you so much for that.
You're welcome.
Thank you. DX from Los Angeles, you're on the air.
Hello, Yatrice. How are you doing?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
Good. I'm doing fine. Thanks for asking. I'd like to wish everybody out there who's listening, I wish they would have a very good weekend this weekend and go out and do something fun and entertaining. And speaking of entertainment, I'm sure you're probably getting a lot of messages about this person you have, forgot his name again, on Wednesday, mostly because of his reviews of Selma. I think that Sarah had a really good point. I know that movies like this and movies in general are supposed to be entertaining, but it goes to this propaganda thing I've called about before. The way Hollywood now uses movies is designed to be a tool, to be a part of what I call the landscape of propaganda. It's not that they're literally saying, okay, this is exactly how it happened, but this is the impression they leave in people's minds, and that's on purpose. Now, I've had conversations with a few people, several people who've seen Selma, including Henry from Chicago. We've had a long conversation about this. He saw the movie. I have not seen the movie because I refuse to give these corporations any of my money. But one thing I told Henry was that once I heard that Oprah Winfrey and Brad Pitt and other people who invested in this movie poured all these millions of dollars into it, I knew exactly what kind of movie it was going to be. And everyone I've talked to who has seen it has fallen somewhere along the lines of Sarah or Henry. Over-dramatized, and that's on purpose, and just pointing out things in the movie that were odd and strange. And that's a way of shaping people's consciousness. So it's not only just the news media, it's also now the movies too, and other entertainment, TV shows that are trying to brainwash us. So we have to be really careful of that. I wanted to make one last comment about the review that the person you had on Wednesday. What is his name, by the way, again?
Almond White.
Almond White, okay. The review he gave of Get On Up, now that's a movie that I did see. I agree with him that the young actor that was playing James Brown did a good job. I agree he did a good job with what he had to work with. But that movie also fell way outside the lines of the actual purview of what James Brown's life really was all about. And I know because I know a couple of people who were still alive who were on his tour, you know, helping out on the tour, like roadies and things like that back in the day. And also I've seen several documentaries on James Brown. And black people don't know that James Brown, who, by the way, was raised in Augusta, South, Georgia, and in South Carolina, I believe, grew up, well, why, I don't know, but he grew up to be a conservative type black person who would go on to endorse Richard Nixon, one of our worst presidents, in the 1972 election. And just one note on James Brown, which they kind of glossed over all of this in the movie and didn't really make it clear, was that in 1967, James Brown had a song called America Is My Home. And basically, he criticized people like Stokely Carmichael and Dr. Martin Luther King for speaking out against the Vietnam War. Well, his popularity with that song, and the lyrics are a mess, they make you mad even to this day. That song hurt him with his popularity, especially with black people. So he felt he had to do something to bring his career back, so he made that song, his biggest hit ever, I'm Black and I'm Proud, in 1968, which ended up number 10 on the Billboard 100 and number 1 on the R&B charts for like 6 weeks, I believe. So that was his biggest hit ever. And so he always had this push and pull with the black community and with progressivism that they didn't care to touch on in the movie.
Well, yes,
it made it seem like, oh, we all get along, we all love James Brown. No, that's not how it was.
James Brown was a very complex man. And
yes, very
I don't
complex.
Think in any one movie you could get everything in there, but we should have a conversation about James Brown because on many, many levels, he was fearless in his championing of his people. And it was an extraordinary risk that he constantly took. And if you appreciate where he came from, and you appreciate the job overall that he did, which was as a cultural igniter, you know, he did a fine job. But we should talk about him some more. That brings us to the end of the program, DX, Bringing Up the Rear. Thank you so much for being with me today. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Wake Up Call with Richard Martin. Reach me at Lead Stories with Utrice Lead or on Facebook. LeadStories@gmail.com. Take care. You see that red northern in Chicago.